This is case 30 from the Sherlock crew. Daswi's Aeonic Fire. Introduction. Obliterating all oppositions, cutting off both sides, smashing the mass of doubt. How does that require a single phrase? The capital is not an inch of step away. The great mountain only weighs 3 pounds. But tell me, based on what order can one dare to speak this way? The case. Monk asks Daswi, when the fire at the end of an eon rages through and the whole universe is destroyed, is this destroyed or not? Daswi said, destroyed. Monk said, then it goes along with that? Daswi said, it goes along with that. Another monk asked Longji, when the fire ending of the eon rages through and the whole universe is destroyed, is this destroyed or not? Longji said, not destroyed. The monk said, why is this not destroyed? Longji said, because it is the same as the universe. The verse. Destroyed or not destroyed? Going along with that, the billion world universe. In their phrases, after all, there is no hook and chain action. Their feet are much obstructed by entangling vines. Do you understand or not? For a matter that is distinctly clear, punctiliousness is extreme. Those who know the heart, bring it forth. Do not haggle. You lose to me, buying and selling in the market. If you think about ordaining, wait till the winter. It's very hot with all this. Hold off on that. For a matter that is distinctly clear, punctilious is extreme. This is what we do, in case you're not sure yet. We are dealing with a matter that is extremely, extremely great and important. Are we practicing well? This is a question. This is not judgment, criticism, creating better or worse. None of that. This is, in fact, what it is nutrient, extremely important nutrient for our practice every day, every morning to ask, what does it mean? What is punctiliousness? What does it mean to be precise, to pay attention to details? What does it mean? Right, so when we hear it, we may react with some contraction, some fear, some, I don't want to do that. But what are we reacting to? Is it that? Is it the words? Or is it our interpretation? All it means is this is the only opportunity you have to be present, to love, to partake, to live. By all means, don't pay attention. By all means, squander. Sure, go ahead. It's fine. Either way, it's fine. Go ahead, get entangled. It's okay. Right? But this is what we need to look at. Those who know the heart, it says, bring it forth. Those who pay attention, bring it forth. Because those who pay attention know the heart. And those who know the heart don't want to do anything else but bring it forth, but love. Don't haggle. Again, go ahead, haggle. right? Yeah, but I'm not sure. I don't feel like it today. The last line says, you lose to me buying and selling in the market. You lose to who? Who is me? Who is haggling? Who is arguing? Who is picking and choosing? Those are the questions to work with. Anyway, today, with this Zazenkai, we're officially concluding the spring angle and the exploration of impermanence. Right? Officially, we are concluding, but obviously, there is great importance to keep inquiring into the issue of impermanence beyond any timeline parameters of an Ango theme. The only purpose of focusing on a specific aspect of our lives during Ango is to raise the level of our awareness in a targeted way so we can dissolve our barriers or hang-ups we may have developed around that particular theme or aspect, and then make it an integrated aspect or part of our post-Zazen practice. Post-Zazen, post-Ango. And especially, this is especially important when it comes to impermanence. And it's important because in our culture, there is a strong aversion to turn towards this aspect of our existence, to turn away, right? To not do what we tried to do over the past 3 months, right? So what we're trying to do is quite the opposite. And our culture is encouraging us to engage in all kinds of activities that distract us. Distract us and create the illusion of permanency, which is the root of our grasping tendencies. But why is it so important that we keep this issue of impermanence at the forefront? Now, deep down, everybody knows that we will eventually die. We understand what impermanence means for us. We know that we can't avoid being separated from everybody we love and everything we care about. So would it make more sense to drown ourselves in a variety of displacement activities that numb us until we meet with the inevitable? Many people feel that staring directly at our own mortality is some kind of a morbid fascination or unhealthy. But in fact, it's quite the opposite. A sober acknowledgement of our own mortality can provide direct encounter with our illusory self and lead us to experiential realization of our true self. It can lead us from bondage to freedom. It can help us stop playing games and start living real. And there are many games we are engaged with on a daily basis. So turning towards rather than away, what's the difference? The impermanent nature of our existence is not up for debate. Whether we choose to live in denial or fully accept and embrace it as an integrated part of life. Either way, that fact will remain the same. So that's not in question. The difference will manifest in the level of ease and authenticity we experience in our lives, and in the kind of consequences we are going to create. So either way, how we live and die will have ripples or ripple effects throughout the entire universe. That's not in question. The ripples are not in question. So the matter of impermanence really matter. If we care. So maybe that's an important question. We say we care. But what does it mean? What's the action of caring, we can ask. And I think the first step in exploring this matter has to begin with acknowledging the great fear we may experience when we ponder our own mortality, or the thought of losing our loved ones. Right? Some may say, I'm okay with my own mortality. But when it comes to losing loved ones, then what? Then how do we feel? And it's natural, another thing to acknowledge, it's natural to experience intense emotions about this grave matter. But such emotions do not have to become solidified to a point of creating a fixed barrier that stops us from exploring further. So we have to know those feelings, those intense emotions, know them well. Know them intimately, and then be gentle and tenacious at the same time. Gentle as in knowing, not being surprised, making space, not self-judging. I should feel different, we may think, but I don't. I should not be terrified, but I am. I am terrified, right? So then what? How do we work with that? Because there is no such, we call it formal practice, but there is no such thing apart of the moment of working with or acknowledging or working with intense emotion. There is no other practice. There is no, well, I'd rather go chant. Because that's another form of this practice can become a form of displacement activity. So there is intense emotion or emotions about that. And the monk in this koan probably experiencing similar intense emotions about his own mortality when it comes to see Dasui and poses this question. So he has this intense emotion, right? Or emotions around it, but at least he's willing to go there rather than avoid it and look for an escape route. So that's notable. It comes with this question. Here I am, exposed, willing to look. So he asks, when the fire at the end of an eon rages through, and the whole universe is destroyed. Is this destroyed or not? An eon in Buddhism is known as kalpa, which is an unimaginably long, long, long time. One way to describe it is with the analogy of an iron mountain, a very big, large mountain, which is brushed with a feather once every 100 years. A kalpa is the time it will take this mountain to fully disintegrate. At the end of the kalpa, of a kalpa, before the beginning of the next, there is a great fire that completely destroys everything. So this monk wants to know if at the complete annihilation of everything, will there be any remaining trace of this? This. Himself, his essence, his being. Is there anything of me that carries over? Can you give me some solace and relief? He's asking his teacher. You can shift if you need. Look yet. Can you give me source? And thus we know knows exactly what he wants. But being deeply compassionate, he snatches away the hungry man's food and gives him real nourishment. Destroyed, he says. The monk said, then it goes along with that? Thus we said, yes, it goes along with that. It goes along with that. What goes along with what? While the fear of annihilation is an automatic and natural response, it is arising out of an unexamined assumption that on the day of our birth, on the day we were born, a fixed entity suddenly appeared in the world. We even have a name for that, right? And it feels as if this entity is separated from its surrounding environment and from its past, its present often, and its future, which is the way we experience our lives. This false sense of separation leads us to a futile attempt to grasp and attach. But since it's illusory, it doesn't work. Does it? Ask, try, look around. So it doesn't work, and such attempts result in emotional and psychological turmoil, and of course, feelings of despair. It can't work. So how do we meet that it can't work or it doesn't work? We can try harder and realize that didn't work either. And keep going, and then at some point, go back to the drawing board. Right? Instead of trying to solve this matter in such a way or answer this question, we have to go back to the question and ask, what's going on? What am I trying to solve? What am I trying to repair or fix here? And even if we believe that we accept impermanence and our own mortality, we are in alignment with it, let's say we think that, we can still find plenty of evidence that would clearly reveal our identification with an unchanging self. So we may think that we have found a way to be at peace with it, at ease with it. But we have to examine. We have to examine our thoughts, our words, our actions, and see if those reveal that or something else. Is there something hiding in my speech, in my reactivities? Often reactivities are the best teachers because they show us exactly where we're at. And again, it's not a judgment. I'm going to keep saying that because I know what you think or what we think or how we operate. It's not a judgment. It's just a point of reference to work with. The evidence that is interlaced through our thoughts, our impulsive reactivities, our speech, and of course, the kind of consequences we create. So to reveal this fixed identity or the attachment to it, all we need to do is ask, what are my triggers? What am I vested in and protecting? Why am I not at ease right now? Who am I? Those are practice questions we should always look at, work with. use to deepen. To deepen more than to answer. Buddhism is not saying that you do not exist. And it definitely does not promote nihilism. It is only teaching that you do not exist apart of existence itself. Which means that your birth and death cannot be markers of separate entity that is cut off from a continuous flow that has no beginning and no end. You are an eternal process. In Living by Vow, Shohaku Kumura says, this body and mind is like a waterfall. It's a good analogy. A river flows past a place where there is a change of height and a waterfall is formed. Yet there is no such thing as a waterfall, only a continuous flow of water. A waterfall is not a thing, but rather a name for a process of happening. So take your name. Work with that. That's not a name of a fixed entity, but rather a name of a continuous process. What does that do? If we work with that in such a fluid way, we work with ourselves. What will that do to how we are when we are triggered, when somebody pushes our buttons? It says, this body and mind is like a waterfall. We cannot distinguish where the waterfall starts and ends because it is a continuous process. Since there is no I, no substance called me, I cannot say I will disappear. I cannot say I will disappear. It refers to this body and mind and to all beings. It is not about mysterious beings beyond the phenomenal world. It never is beyond this. Or another way to say that this is beyond this. Now is beyond what we think about now. So this is very clear. It says ordinary reality. And yet we cannot define it. So it is strange and wondrous. Wondrous Dharma. We see things happening every moment and yet we cannot grasp them. That is the meaning of wondrous Dharma. We cannot grasp it and yet it is not mysterious. It is ordinary things happening every day. Every moment offers to us two kinds of opportunities. Every moment. The first one. An opportunity to perpetuate a false view of self and reality by grasping, attaching, and protecting me and my territory, my story, my self-definition, my belongings, my people, my country. Fortifying a sense of alienation and intensifying the fear of annihilation. Because when we fortify ourselves, we also fortify the fear. We feed the fear. So the more I protect myself, the more concerned I become about myself, and the more afraid I am of dying. So in a way, I feed the fear I feel. And this is the familiar and habitual way of interacting with each other, with life. So that's the first one. The second one, there's also the opportunity, every instance, right? Every occurrence, the opportunity to go beyond this habit by developing trust and in a deeper aspect of our being. and just witness the thoughts, the fearful emotions, the narrated story in the background, the drama I keep feeding. And by watching, something miraculous happens. This magnificent, wondrous Dharma is revealed through our own being. Through, not a part of, but as our own being, as who we are, timeless and precious. So instead of trying to force the changing circumstances to fit our fixed ideas, as a practice, we can flip it around, inject some flow to our fixed ideas of self and match the motion of life. Match the motion of life rather than resist it. How often do you find ourselves saying no first? No. Contract. Then, little by little, okay, I'm willing to go with it. But the first reactivity is shut down, put up a wall, say no. Bring the army or the military to defend. First reaction. What do you want from me? I did all this before and you asked me to do it again or more. No, I don't trust. Right? I don't trust. I don't trust is revealing something. It's revealing to me what I'm protecting. Because if I had nothing to protect, where is the issue of trust? What is it about? So that's punctiliousness, right? That's where it's at. To pay attention, not to just go along with habits one after the other, to stop, pay attention, take a look. You'll be amazed. We'll be amazed by what we discover. Bengala 4th century Indian scholar said, when people have not yet attained the way, they don't see the true form of all beings. Because of causes and conditions of attachments to their own limited views, they engage in various meaningless arguments. They, we, who doesn't from time to time? We all do. Some of us do it more often than others, but we all do. Engage in various meaningless arguments. And then he said, so when a wise person sees something appear, she extinguishes the view of non-existence. Right then and there, extinguish the view of non-existence when something appears. And then when a wise person sees something disappear, she extinguishes the view of existence. Then where's the gap and where's the duality? Can adjust. So Kumura commented on this saying, we usually form a view when we experience something. But Pingala says that when a wise person meets someone or experiences something, she extinguishes or lets go of. To extinguish is to... Okay, to extinguish, we may need to look at it because it's not to eradicate in terms of breaking down something or taking a hammer to it. It's more about exposing something. So let go of preconceptions, he says. So each encounter becomes an opportunity to transform our pre-existing ideas and to set aside our biases and preconceptions. Each experience becomes an opportunity to see a fresh new world. This is an important point. The difference between ordinary and wise is not the difference in the quality of person's intelligence. It's a difference in the attitude with which they meet things in their daily lives. So the attitude, right? So we can meet daily life with from a rigid place, and then examine how does that feel, because we know that. And then change it to meeting life from a dynamic, flowing, moving place. And then see the difference. We form ideas, he said, that become fixed as the basis of our identity. This identity, this way of thinking, or system of values, becomes a limitation and we are imprisoned by it. Difficult to open our perceptions again because it becomes very stiff and we become very stubborn, unmoving. To be a wise person, according to this commentary, we must negate, break, or open up our pre-made system of values every time we experience something. This is not something mysterious, it's very clear. So every time we meet something, right, to open up, and when we open up or break, or create an opening in our pre-made system of values, then what are we going to defend? Because what we defend is ourselves and what we have become identified, attached with as system of values, right and wrong. Right and wrong. How do we go beyond right and wrong? It's a huge question. Because as soon as you say that, either to another, to yourself, a very strong argumentative force arises and retaliates. Of course there is right and wrong. How can you say that? Is there right and wrong beyond our perceptions? Or another way to say, what if I put aside all my preconceived ideas? Now where is right and wrong? Because when I put it aside, then the right and the wrong can become more dynamic, more moving, more fitting. Not fitting me and my story, but fitting with reality. And Pingala is offering us a practical way to dissolve our preconceived ideas on the go and merge with the impermanent nature of reality as we encounter everyday circumstances and interact with other people. And other people is a very important part of this. It's not, it may be easier for us to encounter circumstances because we understand that circumstances are just as such. We can rail against it, but they don't argue back, right? We don't like the weather. We don't like the state of things in our country. We don't like climate change. Maybe we could do something, but at the moment we don't like it, nobody's arguing back. But when it comes to other people, it's a different story. They argue, they trigger us, become difficult. So he says, when something or someone appears, Pingala, when something or someone appears, we should immediately extinguish or negate the automatic formation of an opposite. And when something or someone disappears, again, we should immediately extinguish any opposites. By practicing this way, we can develop an experience or experiential understanding of impermanence. and also interconnected origination, impermanence and interconnected origination are actually very much the same. Because through one we can see the other, which is not the other. What Pingala is saying is that when you appear, the entire world appears. And when you disappear, the entire world disappears. As in sitting, standing, walking. Right? So when you sit down, the whole world sits down. Then in that case, who will you argue with? And so when the fire at the end of an eon rages through and the whole universe is destroyed, is this destroyed or not? Destroyed, he said. Then it goes along with that? It goes along with that. Of course. Everything goes along with everything. Impermanence, interconnectedness, beyond logic, beyond conceptual definitions or trying to understand. Everything goes along with everything. And then there is the second part to this koan. Monk went to see Longji, asked the same question. When the fire-ending eon rages through the whole universe, is this destroyed or not? And the footnote says, those with the same illness commiserate, the two monks. Longji said, not destroyed. Not destroyed. We just covered why it is destroyed. So now, chuck all that. Forget everything I said, right? Because now we're back to something else, not destroyed. The monk said, why is it not destroyed? Longji said, because it is the same as the universe. So destroyed or not destroyed, or and not destroyed, are these two different answers. The commentary says that both it's destroyed and it's not destroyed obstructs people fatally. As long as we see the destroyed and the not destroyed from the fixed perspective of our egoic self-centeredness, neither answer will provide solace to our fearful minds. And we can become further stuck and confused. But if we can open up a little bit, just a little bit, and gently release the tight grip on our self-definition, both answers, destroyed and not destroyed, can provide a roadmap to our liberation. Chogyam Trungpa wrote on a separate self, just his commentary on separate self or ego. I want to bring it up because I think it's very relevant to what we're talking about. He said, there seems to be different ways of using the word ego. To some people, the ego is that which sustains them, that which gives them some kind of guidance, or practicality in dealing with things, as it refers to us, being conscious of being oneself. And you exert effort through it. So any kind of self-respect is referred to as ego, which is a general sense of the term. But ego, as we are discussing it, is slightly different from that in terms of practice. In this case, ego is that which is constantly involved with some kind of paranoia, some kind of panic. In other words, hope and fear. is what the ego sustains itself on. He says that is to say, as you operate, there is a constant reference back to yourself. As you operate, as you go throughout your day, there is a constant reference back to something, to someone, that is constantly asking, is it good? Is it bad? Is it for me? Is it against me? What are they saying about me? Is it up or down, the thumb? This constant trying to reassure something that is always fearful. As you refer back to yourself, then a criterion of reference develops in terms of hope and fear. Gaining something or losing one's identity, it is a constant battle. I would add exhausting, constant battle. That seems to be the notion of ego. In this case, it's neurotic aspect. You could have a basic sound understanding of the logic of things as they are without ego, which is what he's suggesting here. In fact, you can have a greater sanity beyond ego. You can deal with situations without hope and fear. How about that? Is a suggestion. Deal with situation without hope and fear. Just that. Without what will happen, what did happen, what am I going to get out of it? Will it protect me? Will it give me something? All that, put it aside and see what happens. And then he says, and you can retain your self-respect or your logical sanity in dealing with things continuously. You can do so. And you can do so with much greater skill in a greater way. If you don't have to make the journey to and from, and if you don't have to have a running commentary going on side by side with your operation. So if we don't have to constantly check in with our ego, what do you think? Is it good? Should we go? Should we not go? Do we get something here? Should we be afraid of something here? It is more powerful and more definite. You see, getting beyond ego, he said, doesn't mean that you have to lose contact with reality at all. I think that in a lot of cases, he said, there is a misunderstanding that you need ego and that without it you can't operate. And some people actually do say that. And what he's saying here is that's a very convenient basic twist. This is how we deceive ourselves, actually. Hope and fear, as well as the notion of sanity, are amalgamated together and used as a kind of excuse that you need some basic ground to operate, which is, I would say, a misunderstanding. It's the same as when people say that if you are a completely enlightened being, then you have no dualistic notion of things. That is the idea of ultimate zombie, he said, which doesn't seem to be particularly inspiring or creative at all. Either way, whether we are fearful or we think we're enlightened, we can operate in a detached and separated way from reality. And what he's saying here is that we can operate without a sense of ground. And what he's referring to is our made-up sense of ground, not this. That's not in question. We don't even pay attention to that in most cases. We are so enamored with our own set of standards, with our own personal parameters, that we barely notice how supported we are, how unconditionally supported we are, which of course leads to being fearful and being afraid of losing. And it's quite amazing, because when we do die, we nurture the ground that is nurturing us now, don't we? When we die, we become something else, right? Our essence, our physical essence, becomes nutrient to that which is supporting us right now. What Chogyam is pointing at is that the fallacy of what we base our entire life on, and it's a very addictive way of being for us, since our culture is also basing its own identity on the same fallacy. So walking around with a sense of separate self feels very real and very familiar to us. The practice of contemplation, of turning towards our own mortality, is essentially the gateway, or can be a gateway, out of our egoic attachments. Either way, we are born, we live, and we die. So that won't change. But the impact will always be felt through the consequences of our actions, right? The time, the little time that we spend in this realm, within this skin bag, that little time doesn't matter much. But the consequences, think about that. Think about what we're creating, what we leave behind for future generations. That should matter to us, I think. But it's not that we should be too focused on what will happen later, because what we do now will affect what happens later. And it's immediately affecting what's happening now too. Because if we are leading a life of being fearful, walking around protecting something, how do we act? The level of fear, the level of resistance, contraction, constriction of the heart, the limitation of our great capacity for compassion, for love, for being a vehicle of goodness. We're too busy protecting what we don't need to protect, what we cannot protect, what will eventually not be the way it is. So can we let go now? Right? By turning towards, by realizing that no matter how tight I grasp, no matter how great the fear is, no matter whatever is going on, it's not going to work. What will work? Then we relax a little bit. Then we open up a little bit. And then we connect with something. Those who know the heart bring it forth in the verse. Know the heart and you'll bring it forth. How do you know the heart? You stop running around. You stop defending. You stop complaining. You stop pointing a finger. Look at yourself and you will know the heart. And also you will know ease. Unconditional ease. I'm going to go back to Chogyam. This is another this is commentary on disease and dying. He says, in discussing sickness, because this is a very important point, the way we deal with sickness, or what we think about it as an issue with something that we need to fix. In discussing sickness, whether physical or mental, we should recognize the importance of our sense of survival. We want to survive. And when we talk about healing, we are talking about how to survive. Viewed from another angle, our strategy of survival is the pattern of our reaction to the fact of death. One's attitude towards death is central to any healing process. Although it is frequently ignored, it is always in the background. No one actually wants to face the possibility of death, or even the idea of death. Even a mild sickness points to the possibility of nothingness. We might lose control of our physical or mental situation. We might become lost in midair. We are lost in midair now. Facing the fear of loss will not exactly solve the problem, but to begin with, the problem should at least be faced. Which is what this monk is doing. When we are willing to acknowledge what is really happening, we pick up spirit or buoyancy. One could even go so far as to say that by such acknowledgement, some kind of sanity develops. So I think it is very important to present the possibility to people that they might have to face some kind of loss, some sense of bewilderment. Often the whole notion of sickness is taken as purely a mechanical problem. Something is wrong with one's machine, one's body. But somehow that is missing the point. It is not the sickness that is the big problem, but the psychological state behind it. We view our desire to get rid of disease as a desire to live. But instead, it is often just the opposite. It is an attempt to avoid life. Our desire to get rid of it is the attempt to avoid life. Why? Because life, there is no life without sickness, old age, and death. So we can't rail against that and want to hold on to this. This is that. If this is wrong, that's wrong also. And if this is right, that's right. So this is our mad picking and choosing. Although we seemingly want to be alive, in fact, we simply want to avoid intensity, he said. This is an ironic twist. We actually want to be healed in order to avoid life. Think about that. We want to be healed in order to avoid life. So the hope for cure is a big lie. It is the biggest conspiracy of all. In fact, all entertainment, whether it's the movies or various programs for so-called self-growth, lure us into feeling that we are in touch with life, while in fact we are putting ourselves into further numbness. And finally, what do we mean when we say that the patient has been healed? To be healed, ironically, means that the person is no longer embarrassed by life. That's true healing. He or she is able to face death without resentment or expectations. That's real. There's a lot to chew on there. And we should. The Japanese teacher Takuan said, you can't wash your face and hands with ice. Right? That's what happens when we become rigid. It hurts. So we hurt each other and ourselves through our rigidity. And there's another story about Dasui among us. Dasui, when the great matter of life and death arrives, then what? Dasui said, if there is tea, drink tea. If there's food, eat food. And the monk said, who receives this support? That's we said, just pick up your bowl. And you'll know who receives this support. There's another story about Dasui when a large number of people were assembled to hear him. He contorted his mouth into a pained position and said, "Is there anyone here who can cure my mouth?" The monks competed with one another to offer medicine to their teacher. And when lay people heard about this matter, many of them also sent potions. But Dasui refused them all. 7 days later, he slapped himself and caused his mouth to assume a normal appearance. Dasui then said, "These two lips have been drumming against each other all this time. Up until now, no one has cured them." He then sat in upright position and passed away. What a great way to die. What a powerful way to die. Because here we are, over 1,000 years later, learning from that. Amazing. Destroyed, not destroyed. Going along with that, the billion world universe. In their phrases, after all, there is no who can chain action. Destroyed stands alone. Not destroyed stands alone. There is no who can chain action. It's not this, yes, but that, or this, so, that. It's this, and the whole world is this. And then it's that, and the whole world is that. Watch your mind. Watch it now. Watch the hook and chain. When is this ending? I want to go home. I have this going on tonight, and tomorrow, and the day after. No, you don't. No, you don't. So with this conclusion of Ango today, I hope we learned something in the 3 months. I hope we learned something that we can actually use going forward, learn a different way to be with ourselves, to be with others, so we can actually keep working with that, keep turning towards that. Never stop. And truly be a force of good. Thank you.